Hi, Undisclosed listeners. Thank you so much for tuning into the Greg Lance case and to tuning into all of our cases. We couldn't continue to do our work to help the wrongfully convicted without your support. And here's two more ways you can support us and our work. First, please support our sponsors because they support us. The products and services that we bring to you are products and services that we love. They're sponsors that we love. So make sure to patronize them for yourself, for family, for friends, as a gift. Pass it along. And a big thank you to our sponsors who have stood by us for now nearly 5 years. Another way to support us, a really important way, by the way, is to actually subscribe to our podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. And please make sure to leave us a 5-star review because that helps other people discover this podcast. And the more people that listen, the better it is for our work. Thanks again. And now let's get into this week's episode.
Never met him, but I know he's in there for something he did too. Don't let him give up. Your son never got this chance. Even though it's hard, and he knows it's hard, but he just never got the chance to be a daddy that he deserved to be. That's very, very sad.
That was Lacey Harness, who we heard from in last week's episode. Now, to refresh your memory, Lacey was one of the people that we know for sure was at the Horn residence across the street from the Klusnick house on the night they were murdered. Lacey has said many times that he believes Sam and Peggy Horn were responsible for murdering Victor and Alla. And for good reason. Lacey witnessed a lot of things that night and the next morning, and even more things that we'll get into today. But one thing he didn't do is connect Sam Horn to the murder weapon. Remember the Tech 9 with a flashlight and green cord attached to it? The police found it a little over a month after the murders, not far from the victim's house on their next-door neighbor's, Mr. Bohannon's, property. Lacey did say that Sam owned a Tech 9, but he also said that Sam owned hundreds of weapons and they came and went. Sam would get stolen weapons and ditch them, trade them for drugs, hide them on his property, throw them in wells. So Lacey isn't quite clear on exactly when Sam Horn possessed a Tech 9. And he also never says that he saw Sam with a weapon all rigged up with a cord and a flashlight. But that doesn't mean there weren't other ways to connect Sam to the gun. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
You might recall that tracking the weapon ended up being an exercise in frustration for the investigators. They traced the serial number of a weapon to a man named Daryl Smith, and he told them that he traded the gun to Robert Shepard, the owner of Shepard's Auto Sales. And when they checked with Shepard's, well, it checked out. Shepard confirmed that he had in fact gotten the gun from Daryl Smith. But after that, the trail went cold. Shepard thought maybe the weapon was stolen in a robbery at his store that took place in January of 1997, a year and a half before the murders. But the police report that listed all the stolen weapons didn't include the Tech 9. Then Shepard thought he sold it to a man named Tommy Jones. He was so sure of it, he actually called Tommy as the police recorded the conversation and asked him about the gun. Tommy essentially told him to F off. He said he never bought or traded such a gun from him, and there wasn't any paper trail to show that he had either. In an early report, investigator Philip Gentry noted, referring to the detectives who had interviewed both Tommy Jones and Robert Shepard, quote, "They think Jones is telling the truth, and Mr. Shepard, being a used car salesman, could be deceitful." But contrary to their initial instincts, Shepard agreed to a polygraph, which he passed just fine, and Tommy Jones refused to take one. The police even put Robert Shepard under hypnosis, thinking maybe he forgot what he did with the weapon, but the hypnosis didn't produce any leads either. So at the end of the day, they gave up trying to figure out where that gun had disappeared to from Shepard's. And at trial, they were never able to connect it to Greg. In fact, they didn't even offer a theory of how Greg ended up with the gun. They just left that a big blank hole for the jury to fill in with their own imaginations. But Greg didn't give up trying to figure out where the gun came from and where it went. And so in 2005, well after his conviction, he hired a post-trial defense investigator, retired FBI agent Jim Harkham, who tracked down Daryl Smith to talk to him again about when he traded Robert Shepard the weapon.
This time, though, Smith had a completely different story. He never traded the gun to Shepard, he said. In fact, he'd given the Tech 9 to his daughter, Tasha Ann Smith, when she'd gotten married. It was for the express purpose, he said, of using the gun as a down payment for a trailer. A trailer they'd bought from Robert Shepard. Defense investigator Harkham then spoke to Tasha, who confirmed that, yes, her parents had given her the gun to use as a down payment, not long before she and her fiancé at the time were planning on getting married. Tasha married Jerry Beeson in December of 1997, and she recalled that they bought a trailer in the late summer a few months prior. The weather was hot and uncomfortable, she remembered. It was sometime between July and September of 1997. Harkham then visited Jerry Beeson, who was now divorced from Tasha, and he confirmed the same thing from him. The Tech 9 was given to Robert Shepard when he and Tasha had bought the trailer from Shepard shortly before they got married in December of 1997. So, according to these three witnesses, Robert Shepard acquired the gun in the late summer of 1997, a year before the murders. And he got it as a down payment, which means he should have had a record of getting it. But he told investigators that he'd gotten it back in 95 or 96 from Smith. And in fact, Smith had said the same thing when he was interviewed right after the murders, that he had given Shepard the gun in 95 or 96 and traded it to him for a car. But now, in 2005, that story was completely different. And the biggest difference was the timeline of when Shepard got the gun. And all of it was really just based on their statements. At no time did anyone produce any kind of documentation showing when the transaction took place. But if the 2005 statements by Daryl Smith and his daughter Tasha Smith and her ex-husband Jerry Beeson are correct, and Shepard didn't get the gun until summer of 1997, that means it certainly couldn't have been stolen in the January 97 robbery that took place at a store. And if it wasn't stolen in the robbery, that means Robert Shepard got rid of it some other way. A way that apparently he didn't want the police to know about. What could that reason have been? Well, for instance, if he'd used the gun for some kind of illegal transaction, like for drugs. Or perhaps because he didn't want to help the police trace the murder weapon to the murderer because it could put his own life in danger. And that's exactly the theory that Jim Harkham thought for why Shepard hadn't told the truth about how he'd gotten rid of that gun.
I do remember him claiming, you know, he didn't know what happened to the gun or something like that. But I know that my thoughts were that gun was a key thing right there, that it didn't add up. I felt strong that he was not being truthful about it. His knowledge. Now, whether he was afraid of something, I don't know, you know. But yeah. He never did cough up anything about where that gun went to. Shepard knows exactly what happened to that gun. I'm satisfied of that. I was at the time, you know.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, like I say, I've had dealings with Shepard over the years as an agent. And I really felt like I could possibly get it out of him. But I never could. He never would cough up what happened to that gun, what he did with it. I really felt it was a gut feeling that he might have been very concerned of some reprisal from somebody, you know.
Yeah.
But I never tied Sam to that or anything, or anybody, really.
Yeah. I mean, when the TBI comes to him and says, look, this weapon is involved in a murder, and he knows where the weapon went, I'm guessing he didn't want to get involved.
That's all, no question about it. Yeah. I'd say that's exactly right.
Yeah.
In 2005, after talking to Daryl, Tasha, and Jerry, Harcum also interviewed Robert Shepard, and Shepard repeated the robbery story to him. Harcum then asked if he knew Greg Lance. He didn't, said Shepard. But Sam Horn? Yes, Shepard said. He did know him. He didn't say much of anything at all about Sam Horn, though, and Jim Harcum believed then, as he believes now, that the key to solving this case is in whatever it is that Shepard hasn't told anyone.
Let me just throw this out for what it's worth. I always thought Shepard's the key. Not that Shepard had anything to do with it, but I really believe he knows, you know, where that gun came from.
Yeah.
Or where it went to. It was where he went to, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
That was the key. You know, he had it. There's no question about him having that gun at one time.
I think he can conclusively tie the weapon. He knows where it went. He can tie it to...
That was my conclusion on the whole thing, that he knew exactly where that weapon went to and could tie it together. That's exactly right. That was my thought.
Those of you who follow me online know that for the last year and a half, I've been undergoing kind of, I would say, a transformation. I have changed a lot of my habits in terms of diet and exercise, but that's not the most important change I've made. The most important change I made was that I started taking care of my mental health. I never, in 45 years of my life, thought about my mental health, thought about the fact that I should speak to professionals about all the stresses that I go through and all of us go through. And for the most part, it was because it was time-consuming and expensive. It's not cheap. Therapy is not cheap. But that's why Talkspace is a lifesaver. Talkspace is online therapy that's a convenient and affordable way to improve your mental health. What Talkspace does is it pairs you with one of over 5,000 licensed therapists based on your needs and preferences. And you can connect with your therapist via text, audio, picture, or video messages on the same day that you match. You don't have to wait days and weeks to get an appointment. You don't have to wait to see somebody face to face. You can text them the minute that you feel like, look, something is happening. I need to talk to somebody. Your therapist will message you daily, 5 days a week on Talkspace. There's no need for office trips or appointments to schedule. Talkspace Online Therapy matches you once again with a licensed therapist, and they're trained to be an active, non-judgmental listener. With therapy, there's no one-size-fits-all. Believe me, anybody who's been through therapy knows that sometimes it takes some time to get the right match. But Talkspace therapists are trained in more than 40 specialties, 40 different areas of therapy. You'll get stress management techniques, communication skills, and practical tips to help you feel your best. Your therapist will never bring their own opinions to the table, so you can freely share what's on your mind. And Talkspace is affordable. It gives you a month of anytime access for the price of one single in-person therapy session. Talkspace therapists address issues like depression, anxiety, substance abuse, trauma, relationships, food and eating disorders, and more. And they're clinically proven. In one academic study, Talkspace users reported a 50% drop in anxiety after 3 months. And 80% of participants in another study said Talkspace was as effective or more effective than in-person therapy. Look, we all need help navigating life's ups and downs. Talkspace offers you the support you need at an affordable price. This is the time to think about making that transformation and taking care of your mental health. Our listeners can get $100 off your first month by using the code undisclosed at Talkspace.com. Once again, match with a therapist for the fraction of the price of traditional therapy at Talkspace.com or download the app. But make sure to use the code undisclosed to get $100 off your first month. That's Talkspace.com, promo code undisclosed.
Robert Shepard told Harcum that while he knew Sam Horn, he never had any dealings directly with him, which, while possible, is highly unlikely for two reasons. First, while Sam Horn was really well connected to and active in the local gun scene, and second, because Shepard had helped track Sam down after he broke into his friend's business and stole a safe.
We followed the tracks in the snow and traced him down, me and Tom did, and got the safe back.
Do you remember when that was?
No, I don't.
So Sam broke into this other place and stole a safe, and then he was tracked down by his snow tracks?
Well, yeah, we followed his. It had snowed while he was there, and there was only set of tracks on the road. We followed him right to his house.
Wow.
That's the truth.
Still, when we spoke to Shepard, he insisted on the same thing he had for years, that he had no idea where the gun went, and he knew nothing about a connection to Sam Horn. Greg, as we've mentioned before, definitely didn't know Sam, but Greg got to learn all about Sam when he was incarcerated, and it wasn't just from Billy Cleghorn. Others also talked to him, and told Greg they knew Sam Horn was connected to the murder, and they knew he was connected to the gun. One of these men was a man named James Myers. Myers worked at the Bend of the River Gun Shop, the shop that had originally sold the Tech 9 to Daryl Smith before Smith gave it to Robert Shepard. James Myers had a lot of information about Sam to tell Greg. Sam Horn and him had a bit of history, and James wrote that history down in a sworn affidavit in 2014. Back in the late 90s, Sam would come into the Bend of the River Gun Shop nearly every week, said James, to buy all kinds of bullets. Sam was often geeking, said James, and he didn't always want bullets right off the shelf. He wanted stolen bullets. Sometimes he paid for the bullets, and sometimes he traded them for meth. James had no trouble selling Sam bullets because James usually had a supply of both stolen bullets and guns. In his affidavit, James stated, quote, "I stole a lot of guns and sold them to Sam Horn, Alvy Horn, and Mike Horn." Sam, he said, would buy any gun that James could get his hands on. And once, said James, he and three others broke into a house in Jackson County and stole three entire cabinets full of guns. The police traced the theft to his partners in crime, who told the police they had sold all the stolen guns to Sam Horn. Putnam County detectives Doug Burgess and Bobby Lane made a visit to Sam, who denied having them. The police hauled the three snitches in front of Sam to confront him about selling him the guns. They gave him a few hours to turn the guns in, and then they left. Sam, said James, turned over the stolen guns to the police, and no one ever got charged. Not him, not his co-conspirators, not Sam Horn. Which didn't surprise him because, according to his affidavit, when Sam owned his cab service, he used it to sell cocaine. For years, before he got into meth, Sam bought and sold guns and traded them for cocaine, with trades going both ways. And while it was an open secret, Sam was never arrested for any of it. James said that he and most others suspected that Sam had some kind of arrangement with the cops. Maybe he was an informant, because no matter what Sam did, didn't ever seem to get him in trouble with the law. Whatever it wasn't kosher because James Myers said that with his own two eyes, he saw local cops at Sam's house as Sam was cooking meth. And said James, quote, "Most everyone that knows Sam Horn knows he is a killer. Everyone was afraid of him because they know he wouldn't hesitate to kill them if he ever crossed him. It is common knowledge among the people that know him that Horn killed the Russian couple that lived across the road from him."
Now, James Myers wasn't specifically able to connect Sam Horn to the murder weapon, but he wasn't the only one who came to Greg with information. In a handwritten note, Greg documents that two men named Bruce Henry and Derek Wittenberry told him that they had personally seen Sam in possession of a Tech 9 gun with a small black flashlight taped to it. The flashlight, they said, had a knobby rubber handle with a switch on the bottom, and the gun was a little rusty around the end of the barrel area. Now, if you check out the title image for Addendum 4 of this series, you'll see that the murder weapon was in fact rusty around the barrel. But another witness went a step further than these men and told Greg that he not only saw the murder weapon in Sam's possession, but he actually even fired it. And that was a man named Chris Henry that Greg met in prison in January of 2000 as he was awaiting trial. Chris Henry had known Sam Horn for years. They were friends once. And he was one of the many young men who ran dope for Sam, and he was an addict himself. Henry had at one point borrowed stuff from Sam to make his own meth, and when he failed to return it, Sam threatened to kill him. Sam had also pulled a gun on Jackie, as we heard before, and on someone who never expected it, Lacey Harness. Lacey's father was one of Sam's best friends, and Lacey grew up around Sam, so he never thought he would be in danger from him. But he was wrong.
We've been all like family, you know, until he pulled a gun on me. I'm like, man, after all these years and all the stuff we've been through, you know, I'm not going to tell Dad about this. You know, because Dad don't even know nothing like this. You and him still friends, far as he's concerned and far as I'm concerned. I said, you know, I ain't got to come out here. You know, I ain't got to take this chance, you know, get busted with you guys. And, you know, but I did have a couple cars out there, and I just left them. I left the car sitting there. 2 months later, I run into Billy. Billy pulls a gun on me. He was dating Samantha. You know, I seen him at the store, and he followed me down the road. Well, I pull over. Man, what's going on? What do you want? You ain't following me for no reason. You know, he's like, well, Sam told me to give this to you. He whips out a gun. I said, give me what? I don't like that gun. He's like, no, he wants me to shoot you. I looked down, looked through the car, Smith. I said, for real? Your dad's gonna be that way? And she said, Billy, don't do it. Don't do it, Billy. It ain't worth it, you know?
Billy Cleghorn let Lacey go that day, and Lacey stayed away from the horns ever since. And that seems to be the pattern, because that's what Chris Henry did too. Henry stayed out of Sam's way ever since Sam threatened him, knowing that he would make good on his promise to kill him. Chris Henry told Greg that he believed Sam had killed the Klesnikows and he was willing to testify, but he was worried for his own life if Sam found out he had been talking. As he later told Joyce, Chris Henry was scared to death of Sam. But still, Henry drew a map of Sam's house for Greg. He told him that it was impossible for Sam to look out of either one of his front-facing windows and see the Klesnikow house. Sam kept heavy curtains drawn and junk piled up so no one could look out or in, which was not uncommon for a meth house. So that meant that the statement that Lacey Harness gave, that Sam had woken him up as he was asleep in the sofa and that he pointed to the burning house through the window, wasn't true. It couldn't have been true, because there wasn't any way to look through those windows if Chris Henry was right. Well, Greg turned over Chris Henry's information to his attorneys as they prepared for trial. But his defense team never contacted Henry or called him to the stand. But Henry did eventually testify, just not at the trial. Remember, after Greg was convicted but before he was sentenced, his new attorney filed a motion for a new trial at which Greg testified. Well, that was also when Chris Henry testified. Henry told the court that Sam Horn had told him that the Russians had threatened to turn Sam in for manufacturing meth because he had fallen behind in his mortgage payments. This conversation, Henry said, took place before the Klesnikows were murdered. Henry went on to testify that Sam told him that he would, quote, knock on their front door. He said he was too old to go to prison, that he would die before he got out anyway, that he would knock on their front door, shoot them, and burn their house down behind him and leave. And later, after the Klesnikows had been killed, said Henry, Sam told him that he had taken care of the problem. And Henry understood that to mean that Sam had killed Victor and Alla. Chris Henry also told the court that not only did Sam Horn own a Tech 9, Chris Henry had fired that Tech 9 himself. But District Attorney General William Gibson was quick to get Chris Henry to admit on cross-examination that he was a meth addict, that he was on meth at the time he says all of these things happened, and that Sam Horn was also on meth at the time he allegedly said anything about the Klesnikows. And that caused enough damage to his credibility that Chris Henry's testimony wasn't strong enough evidence to grant Greg a new trial.
It was the same tactic D.A. Gibson used to prevent Billy Cleghorn from testifying before the jury at Greg's actual trial the previous year. We heard from Billy Cleghorn in last week's episode, and he told us, as he said in many statements over the years and in court, that he was at Sam Horn's house that night, the night of the murders. Billy said that he'd pulled into Sam's driveway as the Klesnikow house was burning, and that Sam had come rushing out to tell him to leave before the police got there. Billy also later heard Peggy and Samantha say things that were incriminating about their family's involvement in the murder. Now, remember, Billy had told all this to Greg in prison a good year before Greg's trial. And he'd also told the authorities. He'd even sent them to talk to Paula Lackamore, who corroborated some of his statements. Billy did testify at the trial the following year, in October of 2000, just not in front of the jury. The prosecutors objected to Billy's testimony, telling the court that it would be mostly hearsay. So the judge had Billy testify outside of the jury's presence to determine whether any of it was admissible. Billy told the court that Samantha relayed to him that she was on the porch the night the murders took place, having fallen asleep on a recliner out front. She awoke to the sound of gunfire and saw lights go on across the road. Not long after, her parents had returned from the Kliznikow house with a bunch of stolen items, and she could smell gasoline on them. Billy also told the court that when Sam and Peggy came over to Jackie's, Peggy had been rambling. Billy stated, "It didn't make no sense, you know, stuff she was going on about. She didn't really say nothing. She was saying little stuff like she left her blouse, which I didn't know what she was talking about, you know what I mean? She said stuff like the best way to kill somebody is to tie a flashlight on a gun. Then she said something about she left her blouse over there." While the testimony seemed like compelling evidence for Greg Lance, the court found that it had to meet a standard defined by the Supreme Court in Tennessee versus Howard Brown, that the accused's right to a defense trumps the hearsay rule and therefore allows a confession to a crime to be admissible from someone who isn't present to testify if that confession has been sufficiently corroborated and the hearsay testimony has an indicia of reliability. In order to test the reliability of Billy Cleghorn's testimony, he was recalled to the stand to be cross-examined. And on cross-examination, D.A. Gibson got him to admit that Billy, Sam, Peggy, Samantha, the entire lot of them, had been essentially high on meth the entire time frame of the crime. He also drew out from Billy that he had not come forward with this information until a year after the crime, and after he had been arrested. The prosecutor pressed him to admit that he'd only come forward offering the information because he'd been hoping for some kind of a deal. Billy didn't admit that, but he did admit under cross that Sam and him hadn't been on good terms for a bit, ever since Billy had shot Sam in the rear end. Something else that Billy told us about when we went to visit him.
There was an incident between you and Sam where he got shot. Can you tell us about what happened there?
It was an accident.
It was an accident.
Okay. What happened?
We did all the pistols around the house, and he had a little, like a little Derringer.
Okay.
And it's like a little revolver. And it's just so small that you just put a little trigger back, and then he's got a little hammer.
He's gone.
I was playing with it, and it just went off and shot him on the table.
Yeah. He had to go to the hospital?
Yeah.
Oh, under the table?
Yeah.
That's how. Okay.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was an accident. But it certainly didn't look good for Billy that he was now here testifying against Sam. Finally, D.A. Gibson pointed out that Billy had a record of 51 charges, going all the way back to when he was 10 years old. It's worth noting here that Prosecutor Gibson didn't disqualify any of his own witnesses for drug use or for criminal histories or even for severe mental illness. Gibson only considered these matters to be disqualifying when they applied to the defense's witnesses. And despite it being clear that by the time of trial, Billy Cleghorn had nothing to gain by testifying against Sam Horn. Still, Gibson was determined to keep his testimony out. And he succeeded. Billy's drug and criminal history deeply undermined the reliability of Billy's proffered testimony. And besides, as D.A. Gibson pointed out, Billy was just relaying what he'd heard other people say, people who could have been subpoenaed by the defense. Which was a good point. Sam, Peggy, Samantha, they all could have been subpoenaed for the defense to attempt to get the same information into the record. Believe it or not, they actually were subpoenaed at the insistence of Greg's mother, who forced his reluctant attorney to go along with it. But it amounted to nothing. The Horns appeared in the courtroom one day with what appeared to be their own attorney, and Joyce heard the lawyer tell them they could all leave, and they did. It was never clear to her what happened, but presumably Greg's attorneys made it clear to the Horns' attorney that the defense had no intention of calling the Horns to testify. Ultimately, the jury never heard any witness testimony connecting Sam or Peggy Horn to the murders.
I have had a very strange love-hate relationship most of my adult life with deodorant. I know that you did not expect that line to be coming at you, but this is the truth. Almost every deodorant I've ever used, after like 6 months, 8 months, just stops working on me. But I stopped having that problem when a year ago, maybe more than a year ago now, I made the switch to Native deodorant. Now, Native makes all kinds of safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day. Not just deodorants, I mean, you should check out some of their other stuff, but I am hooked onto their deodorant. I buy it for myself, I buy it for my daughters, my daughter who's an adult, and my daughter who's a preteen. Because they're safe, they are formulated without any aluminum, parabens, talc, and they use natural ingredients like coconut oil, shea butter, tapioca starch to absorb the wetness. Native never tests on animals, and they've got free shipping and returns. And all of that's important. But what's most important for me is that it works, because I don't want to relive the nightmare of suddenly my deodorant turning off. And Native doesn't do that. I don't know why, but Native doesn't do it. And Native comes in a wide variety of great scents for men and women, and they release new limited edition seasonal scents throughout the year. But I'll be honest, my tried and true favorite scent is their coconut vanilla. It is delicious. I do not try to taste it, but it is like the first layer of good smelling stuff I put on my body after I shower, and then I layer up other things. And people in the podcast industry, well, they know how I smell. I smell pretty good. So check out Native products yourself and get 20% off your first purchase. All you gotta do is visit nativedeodorant.com and use undisclosed during checkout. Once again, get 20% off your first purchase by going to nativedeodorant.com and using undisclosed during checkout. Look, Native deodorant has over 9,000 five-star reviews, and there's a reason for it. And I'm one of those, by the way. So check out Native again for 20% off your first purchase by going to nativedeodorant.com and using the promo code undisclosed during checkout. Other than the witness testimony, there was one actual piece of physical evidence concerning Sam Horn that Greg's lawyers tried but failed to get into the record at Greg's trial. It's a truly strange document that makes you wonder what was really going on with investigators, why they seemed to be actively ignoring what was as plain as day right in front of them. That document is dated September 18, 1998 at 11:15 a.m., the morning after the murder weapon was found at the Bohannon farm. A cover sheet to the document notes, quote, Putnam County investigators Doug Burgess, Gary Roach, and arson investigator Philip Gentry talked with Sam Horn. Attached to this memo is a copy of the notes they took, along with a drawing of the gun made by Sam Horn. The document attached to the memo is handwritten, and it's captioned with the title, Drawed by Sam Horn. Underneath the caption is the hand-drawn image of a gun. One that looks an awful lot like the gun the police had found the very night before, down to what seems to be something attached to the top of the barrel of the gun, something that could well be a flashlight. Next to the gun, it's written, quote, middle of 1992, Claude Wright had a gun that looked like this drawing. Claude Wright came out of the door of his home carrying the gun. Now, Claude Wright, in case you don't remember, given the avalanche of names this case involves, was Victor Kolesnikow's handyman, and he lived at Greg's trailer park. From what we know, he was also the last person to see Victor alive the night before the murders, when Victor came to the trailer park to do the inspection, but he didn't cross paths with Greg. And Sam Horn would have known Claude, because Claude was often at Victor's place doing odd jobs. Now, a lot of things about this document have baffled me. First, we don't know why or how the document came to be. Did the police go to Sam Horn after they found the murder weapon? If so, why? Or did Sam himself go to the police, having somehow found out that they found the weapon, in the hopes that he could deflect attention towards someone else instead of him? After all, Sam Horn had no idea that Greg was already the investigator's lead suspect. So in Sam's mind, he might have thought it was best to put the investigators on Claude Wright's tail when it came to the gun. But if that was the case, why did he specifically note that he saw Claude with a gun in 1992? Why didn't he place the gun in Claude's possession closer in time to the crime? And if Sam was alleging that he saw Claude with this gun in 1992, was he alleging that even way back then it had a flashlight attached to it? To be fair, it might be unreasonable to try and figure out why Sam, who was high on meth constantly, was doing anything at that point. But what about the investigators? Why didn't they look at this picture and think, wait a minute, wait just a minute? Which brings me back to the same question I've raised, the same question everybody wonders about. Why was Sam Horn like rubber when it came to criminal culpability? Sam Horn drew this weapon for the police the day after they found it, a month after the Klesnikows were murdered. But there's no indication the police did anything at all to investigate Sam after he made this drawing. They didn't search his property. They didn't take his fingerprints. And by the time Greg's trial took place 2 years later, they had Billy and Paula's statements. They had to know there was a strong reason to suspect Sam Horn, but they did nothing about it. And we know that they knew how likely a suspect Sam was because on December 13th in 1999, 10 months before the trial, defense investigator Ronald Lax stopped by to speak to Assistant District Attorney Patterson. In a report of that meeting, Lax wrote,
"He began the conversation by bringing up Sam Horn and the information which had been developed implicating Sam Horn in the murders. He added that information at least gave us something to chase and could definitely be used as reasonable doubt. I asked him if he was not pursuing those areas of investigation, and he stated that TBI agent Robert Kropsik was pursuing those leads." Patterson then added that he had rather prosecute Sam Horn than Greg Lance. He went on to state Sam Horn and Clegg Horn both had bad reputations in the area. He also provided information that Sam Horn's daughter Samantha Horn, who was only 17 years of age, but who was dating Clegg Horn, was recently arrested for shoplifting. He said the items she was shoplifting were consistent with someone who was trying to operate a meth lab.
Well, as we explained earlier, Greg's lawyers did attempt to point to Sam Horn as an alternate suspect at the trial, but they weren't able to make a dent in that direction. People who were at the trial and those who subsequently reviewed the trial transcripts pretty much all thought that Greg's lawyers failed him on that and other fronts.
I just remember at the trial, I read the transcript back then, and they did a terrible job. I mean, terrible, I thought.
His lawyers, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you've read it, you'd see
I
the
have.
Same thing.
Yeah, I did. I believe that. They dropped the ball many times, yeah.
I can't even remember who his lawyers were, but anyway, I just remember that I thought it was awful the way, you know.
But well before trial, anytime anyone spoke directly to TBI agent Kropsik about the Horns, because remember, Assistant DA Patterson said that Kropsik was the lead in checking out Sam Horn, Kropsik just wasn't interested.
They weren't trying to hear it.
They didn't want to hear it.
No. Because you know how it is. Once they charge somebody, they wouldn't want it.
They don't want to go back.
I can't believe it. They didn't even do nothing. With Sam, I don't know about that deal. I'll tell you the truth.
Lacey Harness told Greg's mother, Joyce, the same thing, that he twice spoke to TBI agent Kropsik and both times told him the Horns were involved, but that Kropsik didn't want to hear it.
I told this guy, not Greg, but I told that investigator, I said, you
Jim
know
Harcum.
As good as I do, not the TBI.
The TBI, tell them? What did you tell them?
I told him that I knew Sam did it, but you know, he didn't want me to exactly come out and say Sam did it because he would put me and my family in danger. But he didn't want me to say that Sam did it. He tried to cover up the fact. He said, well, nothing you say is going to help anyway. You was on meth. Just because I was there don't mean I was on meth. All right. Now, wait a minute. You're supposed to be investigating this case. This was after Jim. He's like, you know, we know Sam did it. And
Bob Kropsik said he knew that
Sam
did
it. Yeah, he said, we know Sam did it. Sam and Peggy did it. I feel so bad about the boys still being in jail over it. But that Bob convinced me, you know, there's nothing I can do to help him, you know.
We may never know why investigators turn a blind eye to the most likely suspect in this case, Sam Horn. But 2 decades later, we do have a clearer understanding of what happened on the night the Klesnikows were murdered. And that is thanks again to what Lacey Harness told Joyce this year. Thank you.
We began this series by laying out the timeline of the crime in episode 1. It seemed that everything pertinent that happened on August 5th, 1998, took place not long before the 3:30 a.m. 911 call that was placed alerting the authorities that the Kalisnikow house was on fire. The Redmond brothers, David and James, who lived across the street, told authorities they had arrived home from work around 2:30 a.m., and when they did so, the Kalisnikow house was quiet and only the Kalisnikow's own two vehicles were parked in their driveway. The brothers retired to their respective trailers, grabbed some food, and were getting ready to turn in for the night when they heard a boom-like explosion that was definitely not gunfire, and then heard a loud car peel away from the scene. Neither of them saw the car, so they couldn't describe it, but they both said they saw it take off toward town, though by the time they got to trial, James changed his story and said he actually saw the car slowly come down Victor's driveway and then take off. Nonetheless, David went over to James's trailer and James had his wife call 911. Neither brother reported hearing a car approach the area after they got back from work, so the authorities weren't sure how Greg or whoever the perp was arrived to the Kalisnikow house without being noticed. Both brothers were sure there was no third unknown car at the Kalisnikow house when they arrived home from work, which meant the perp had to have gotten there after they got home. The police tried to do a reenactment in the dead of the night, which the Redmonds witnessed, but it didn't pan out. They tried to cruise a car with its engine off down the road and up the Kalisnikow driveway, and they weren't able to recreate the sound of the car driving away that the brothers said they heard. That's no surprise, though, because the most likely scenario is that there was no such car, and the Redmonds concocted this story as a red herring. Or, the car they heard speeding away was Billy Cleghorn booking it out of there after Sam told him to scram. Now, in the hours after the murders, the police interviewed the two brothers, but not their wives. But before the trial, defense investigator Ron Lax did speak to the wives, and both of them told him the Redmonds had arrived from work not around 2:30 a.m., but in fact around 1 a.m. In fact, James Redmond also told Lax the same thing, that he'd gotten home around 1 a.m., but that he hung out until around 2:30 or 3 a.m., and then went to bed but woke up when he heard the fires from across the street. David, however, maintained that he arrived home around 2:30 a.m., which didn't add up for a few reasons. First, there's the fact that three other witnesses put him at home at 1 a.m. Next, there's the fact that the brothers told Ron Lax that they rode home together from work because they both worked at the same company. And finally, there are their time cards. They show they punched out around 12:45 a.m. It was a 15-minute drive home, so it seems pretty certain the brothers got home around 1 a.m. And that's very, very important. Because remember, Greg was captured on video at the mini-mart buying beer around 12:45 a.m. Not long after Greg was seen at home eating in his kitchen by the state's own witness, Eric Tanner. You may recall when Eric Tanner was initially interviewed, he told the police he saw Greg at home at 1:30 a.m. But at trial, he testified it was 12:30 a.m. Tanner had to be reminded by defense counsel that no, he had originally said it was at 1:30 a.m. Now, we told you in a previous episode that this time change that Tanner was trying to make at trial was significant. That's because Eric Tanner didn't just pull that 12:30 a.m. time out of nowhere. The state knew that Greg was seen at the mini-mart at 12:45 a.m. They couldn't get around that fact. If Eric was able to establish that Greg was home at 12:30 a.m., the state could have then argued that Greg left the house, stopped for beer after Eric saw him and not before, then went straight to the victim's house and got there before the Redmonds got home from work for that night. But if Greg was buying beer at 12:45 a.m. and Eric saw him at 1:30 a.m., that means that Greg would have arrived at the victim's house after the Redmonds got home from work, and they couldn't figure out how he could do that. Luckily for the state, they never had to fill in that big hole. The jury didn't catch it, and defense counsel failed miserably in pointing it out. We're constantly challenged to find a daily balance in our lives due to the demands of work and the need to feel constantly productive. A powerful way to take back your time and be present is right in the kitchen. Equal Parts is here to help you get into the flow of home cooking, with inviting cookware and coaching designed to introduce new ideas and keep you engaged with the process of cooking one step at a time. That's what's cool about Equal Parts. They sell cookware that's built from high-quality, environmentally responsible materials. And then they add equal parts coaching from real chefs who are standing by 7 days a week to provide one-on-one expertise and insight into every step of the cooking process. I recently got a chef's knife from Equal Parts to replace the dull knives I've been using for the past few years. The Equal Parts knife is the best I've ever owned. It allows me to chop through veggies much more quickly and cleanly than other knives. I was so inspired, I decided to tackle a new dish, bouillabaisse. While I might not have tried this on my own, Equal Parts is a really cool feature where you can text chefs 7 days a week for assistance, which made all the difference in the world to me in preparing my bouillabaisse. So get into the rhythm of the kitchen with friendly and inviting cookware, coaching, and guidance from Equal Parts, all with free shipping and free returns. Visit equalparts.com and get 15% off any purchase with the code undisclosed. That's equalparts.com, enter code undisclosed.
Another big missing piece during both the investigation and the trial was establishing where the horns were that evening. When the police spoke to Sam and Peggy, they told them they had been in Nashville all evening and returned home around 1:30 a.m. They said they'd gone to sleep around 2 a.m., but then woken up when they heard the fire trucks. There is no evidence, though, that the police had actually checked that story out. And the Redmonds, in their initial statements after the murders, they never mentioned the horns either. They didn't mention if they were at home, when they got home, what they were up to at all that evening. Neither did any of the other neighbors who came out that night to witness the Klistenkow house burn down. Witnesses such as Sally Pliciotti and Don Savage. Sally lived to the immediate left of Victor and Alice's house and walked down the road when she heard the fire engines. In her statement the next morning, she stated, "I did not see the people from the wood siding house in the 2 hours I waited to hear about the Klistenkows." The house she's referring to is the Horn residence. And Don Savage of Savage Auto Parts, who lived a bit further down from Sally, said in his statement that he hurried out of his house and went down the hill towards the Klistenkows when he heard the fire trucks pull up. He said he was almost there at the Klistenkows' house when, quote, "I heard a hammering or pecking sound and thought the firemen were trying to tear a window or a wall out, possibly to get someone out. Then I hurried up to help, but that turned out to be someone working in the back of the old West house." The old West house he's referring to was, again, the Horn residence. And when we went to meet Mr. Savage, he told us the same thing. That night, as the fire was raging, he heard hammering like someone was doing construction work from the back of the Horn house. But the horns themselves, he said, were nowhere to be seen. And both Sally Pliciotti and Don Savage noted that while normally there were floodlights on 24/7 at the Horn house, on the night of the fire, it was eerily dark. If what Lacey Harness had to tell Joyce was true, there was every reason for the horns to have kept the lights off and to disappear. Because if Lacey is right, that night they had murdered Victor and Alec Klistenkow. On August 3rd, the Klistenkows had filed an eviction and foreclosure notice against David Redman. That was what alerted Sam and Peggy that they were running out of time and that they had to take care of things soon. So, according to Lacey, on the afternoon of August 4th, Sam and Peggy drove their van across the street and into the field behind Victor and Alice's house.
But I do know I did see Sam and Peggy go across that field in that van, and it was unmistakable. Like I said, the side door had gone off up and one of the back doors.
They came back and forth during the day, but late that night, said Lacey, he sat down on the porch watching across the street because Sam and Peggy were behind the Klistenkow house in their van. When the cops asked him if he'd seen any cars coming or going that night, he said no, he hadn't. But he didn't, of course, tell them that the horns had been stalking the Klistenkows.
And he's like, "Well, do you remember the maroon car or the car a vehicle pulled in?" I'm like, "No. There ain't been nobody over there all night." So I was sitting there waiting on Sam to come back across the field in the van. And I said, "No, I ain't seen nobody come or go."
Now, we heard from Billy that Samantha Horn told him that her mother Peggy had gone over earlier in the day and asked Ala to use her bathroom. And when she'd done so, Peggy had unlatched a window from the inside, a technique that she had perfected with her mother, Rose Redman, when they had burgled antique shops and houses.
Late that night, either Sam or Peggy snuck into the Klisnikow house through that window and shot the victims.
I didn't hear any gunshot because I don't know if that gun had one of them baffles on it, silencers on it or not. But Sam had a silencer there for it. I don't know. I know your boy didn't do it, though. I do know that.
That could explain why no one heard gunshots that night. Not the Redmonds, not the neighbors Pellicciotti and Savage, both of whom had multiple times told investigators that they had heard gunfire from the Horn residence all the time. But that night, they hadn't heard anything. Lacey didn't say that he definitely knew what happened inside the Klisnikow house, but he had heard things. From where? He doesn't say.
Somebody had mentioned he was shot several times, but it was like, just random. You know, he had one in his leg, and one in his abdomen, and one in his chest, around his heart, in his shoulder, and in the head. That's a lot of shooting.
Lacey then says something interesting that may be his way of giving us a clue as to what really happened.
Who to know how long he'd been dead? See? Nobody knows how long before they went back and cleaned up the mess. They was over in the field by themselves, and it could have happened when they first went over there. Because she was supposed to have been paying her rent. And she was behind in the rent. And, you know, as somebody would probably rent, would be like, yeah, come on in. Give my money. You know? And that's when, it could have took place any time of the day.
That's a fair point. There isn't any reason to believe that Victor and Ala were killed right before the house went up in flames. They could have been murdered hours earlier, giving the Horns time to go through the house and search for the deed that Peggy desperately wanted, as well as to snatch up the item she wanted to keep for herself. But all that searching leaves behind clues, and one way to get rid of the clues, any evidence the Horns had been there, was to burn it all down.
Fire actually started, and it was actually coming out of the roof. By the time it was coming out of the roof, you know, he had time to make it back home and take a shower. Because I don't know how far back their bedroom was or exactly where it was in the house, but if it was me, you know, it would have started in the bedroom because that would have been where the most had been touched. You know, after they was shot, you know, it probably would have been the first place they searched and touched everything and then went there on out through the house looking for whatever, you know, their safe or their papers or whatever.
Joyce asked Lacey if he knew whether Samantha had gone over to the Klisnikow house with her parents, but he denied it. He said both Samantha and his sister Jenny were asleep the entire night. And he said again, he was asleep until Sam woke him up, dripping wet from a shower, and told him about the fire across the street. The Redmonds came to the door of the house, said Lacey, but they didn't come in. They just came by to tell them that 911 had been called. Lacey walked outside, down to the end of the driveway, he said, before the police got there, and noticed something.
You know, the garage door was shut back.
Okay.
When the house was on fire.
Okay.
Because I do remember that, because I walked up to David's house and was talking, I said, man, what's going on? He's like, I don't know, I just got home. But when I looked over there, the garage door was shut.
Okay.
But the garage door was shut when I went up to David's, stood at the edge of the driveway. The night it was on fire.
Now, to orient you, if you were facing the Klisnikow house from the road, their bedroom was at the front right part of their house. That was the part of the house that had almost completely burned to ashes. The burn pattern ran through the house from their bedroom, through their kitchen, and out to the garage, which was on the far left side of the house, again if you were facing the house from the road. and outside the garage was the long driveway where the Kolesnikov vehicles were standing that night. According to Lacey, the Horns shot the Kolesnikovs, searched the house, made a trip or two to retrieve the items they wanted, and then went back to burn the house down. They poured gas from the bedroom to the house and out to the garage, but then closed the garage door as they left. And the gas can they used to haul the gasoline to commit the arson? Lacey said that Peggy had mistakenly left it inside the garage before she closed it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he had a garage door opener, and that's where they found her gas can inside the garage door. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The gas can
that
Peggy's,
she snatched Peggy. Up out of that cop's hand. Yeah.
Was actually
in the garage, yeah.
What Lacey's referring to there is that the next morning, Peggy saw one of the police officers on the scene with her gas can. She booked it across the street and snatched it out of his hand. And, inexplicably, the police officer let her. Now, we raised the question of the mysterious gas can, whether one even existed, in the first episode of this series. All the newspaper accounts quoted the sheriff as saying numerous times that no gas can was found on the scene. He went even further, saying any gas can used in the arson would have likely been incinerated along with the rest of the house. But then we had the TBI report that do list a red plastic container, but never call it a gas container. At trial, though, the state's expert did say that she tested a gas can that was given to her, and to no one's surprise, showed it contained gasoline at one time.
I can't tell you how many times I have peered closely at the color crime scene photographs, straining to see if I could identify a red plastic gas can. There's a red cooler in some of the pictures, but that's presumably containing the water for the first responders. You can also see some red plastic buckets in the distance, way behind the house near the chicken shed. But there's not a single picture of a red plastic gas container, or whatever the red plastic container was that was taken into evidence. There are, however, other pictures that made me pause. It's a series of four pictures showing an investigator leaning over a reddish, rusty, metal barrel-like container, which looks like it's about 20 inches high and a foot in diameter, with a 2 to 3 inch hole on the top. The investigator takes out a length of cotton, lowers it into the container, and then packs up the cotton into an evidence box. If you check out the documents for this week's episode, you can see the pictures yourself. There is no mention of this metal container, which clearly looks like a gas container, in the evidence log or at trial. It just disappears. I had no idea, not until Joy spoke to Lacey Harness and his sister Jenny Harness, what the relevance of this container was. And it was by sheer luck that we were able to figure it out. Lacey and Jenny's mother knew the Horns very well because, remember, her husband was best friends with Sam. Today, Mother Harness is quite elderly and unwell. She has periods of lucidity, but she isn't always there. It just so happened that when this series began airing, the Cookeville Herald Citizen newspaper ran a small piece about it. Here's Jenny talking to Joyce about it.
She hadn't had a newspaper in years, hadn't really read the news. She listened to the radio and stuff, but somebody had brought her a newspaper out of the blue. And this was in the newspaper like it was meant for her to see it.
And that jogged Mother Harness's memory. Because remember, the morning after the murders, Jenny's parents came to the Horn House to pick her up. They were all there when the police was across the road still sifting through the crime scene.
And then she's like, wow. And then she starts talking. She's like, yeah, Peggy was saying something about her gas can. When the news people were there, they was collecting evidence and stuff. And Peggy wanted to know why they had her gas can.
Her old antique gas can.
And I said, I know it was an antique gas can, because back then she collected just like sticks of wood, weird shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry for my language, but it was just kind of like, why would you have that in your house? Mm-hmm. Like random just sticks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was odd to me. It still is odd to me. And I'm like, okay. But it's kind of like she said that for a reason.
Yeah.
And my mom was like, what do you mean your gas can?
She took, okay, the police come out of that house with her gas can in his hand. And she walks over and snatches it out of his hand. He goes, there's my gas can. And I'm like, what?
The picture of the rusty metal gas can, that was Peggy's can, the antique can that she left inside the garage, according to Lacey. And because she marched across the street and took it from the investigator, it just disappeared from the evidence altogether. Just to be clear, neither Lacey or Jenny Harness or their mother had any idea that we had these pictures, and no one asked them about this can or any gas can. But their information plugged a hole in the case that we weren't able to until now, and the pictures corroborate their account, which lends overall credibility to what the Harnesses have been telling Joyce. But not complete credibility. Because despite Lacey insisting that he fell asleep on the night of the murders on the Horns' front porch and then miraculously ended up on the sofa inside the house, which is oddly the same exact story Samantha says happened with her that evening, all of it's highly unlikely. That's because Lacey knows too much. He swears that Samantha and his sister Jenny were asleep all night inside the house and they never went across the street to the Klusnick house. How would he know that if he was asleep all night himself? He couldn't know it. He couldn't be certain of it unless he was awake. Lacey knows after the Klusnick cows were killed, the Horns spent a lot of time in the bedroom searching, and then they expanded their search to the rest of the house. How does he know that? He never said that Sam or Peggy ever mentioned it to him or anyone else. No one else has ever relayed this information, unlike some of the other stuff that we know numerous people heard Peggy say in the days after the murders. Only Lacey knows this detail. Lacey knows that Peggy left her gas can inside the garage. How did he know that? Because all Lacey says is that he saw an investigator outside in the yard with a gas can and Peggy going over there and snatching it away from him. Lacey has no way of knowing where that investigator found the gas can inside the house. And Lacey knows something else. He knows that the Horns closed the garage door behind them after they were done, because Lacey said he walked over to David Redmond as the house was burning across the street and that he could see that the garage door was closed. He doesn't say that he heard from anyone that the garage door had been closed. He says that he saw that it was closed. But that's impossible. There is no way to see the Klusnick House garage door from the Redmond or Horn properties. The garage door was on the far side of the Klusnick House, facing in completely the opposite direction. In fact, we even have a picture of the Klusnick house taken the morning of the murders that proves there's no way to see the garage door, because that picture is taken from the driveway that leads up to the Horn and Redmond homes, exactly where Lacey Harness says he was standing. And we'll include that picture in this week's documents on our website so you can see it for yourself. Which all means that the only way Lacey could have seen that the garage door was closed was if he was on the Klusnickow property with the Horns when they left it. And it's also the only way he could have known many of the other random details he threw in, like where Peggy left her gas can and where they searched for the deed and that no one else was there. He knows all of this because he wasn't asleep on a porch across the street. Lacey Harness was with Sam and Peggy Horn at the Klusnickows the night they were murdered. Hi, Undisclosed listeners. I am really excited to share a brand new podcast with you, a podcast series that I'm pretty excited about because I actually got to be involved in it. It's the podcast by Netflix called Because I Watched. Because I Watched explores how television and movies shape our lives. Every single week, Because I Watched shares true stories from across the globe that are touching tales inspired by our favorite TV shows and read by the stars who inspire us, like Helena Bonham Carter, telling the story of two Indian sisters brought together by The Crown, or Bobby Burke narrating the tale of a Venezuelan mother recognizing her own prejudice after watching Queer Eye. And then there's the episode about the Netflix original series, Delhi Crime, which tells us the true horrific tale of a 2012 gang rape that shook not just Delhi, India, but the entire world. And I was one of tens of millions of people who was just rocked by that story. Well, after Netflix aired that series, Across the Border, it's inspired Pakistani journalist and author Beena Shah, someone who actually I happen to be friends with, to write an editorial that was read all across the subcontinent and even caught the eye of the Pakistani president. Well, I was lucky enough to be asked, honored really, to script this episode chronicling all these events. And that episode actually drops tomorrow, the Delhi crime episode, and it's going to be narrated by lead actor in the series, Shefali Shah. So please check out Because I Watched, subscribe to it on all of your podcast apps, and definitely check out the episode that I got to write tomorrow, December 4th.
But aside from those questions that Lacey's statement leaves us with, there's no evidence he was actually there that night in the house when Victor and Ala were shot. And Lacey Harness doesn't have a criminal record, not one that we were able to find anyway. And even though a few people who knew the Horns say that it was Peggy who shot the Klizen cows and Sam who burned the house down, Peggy doesn't have a violent criminal history either. All of Peggy's offenses have been related to theft, drugs, or writing bad checks. And no one has ever reported seeing Peggy even holding a weapon, much less firing one. And no one has ever reported seeing her physically threaten anyone, or in any other way be violent. As for Sam, well, there's pretty much no one we've met who knew Sam who wasn't at one time or another threatened to be killed by him, or had a gun pulled on them by him. It was Sam who owned dozens and dozens of weapons, and was always shooting things up. And it was Sam who got in a nearly physical altercation with Victor as well, over the well he wanted to build. And it was Sam who told numerous people that he would have to take care of the Klizen cows before they turned him in for making meth. And then there's this, that more than one person heard Peggy after the murders say something to the effect of, quote, "This is now three people I have helped kill." While we can't be sure who this third person would have been, it could be Charles Hamlet she was referring to, the businessman that the Horn set up to blackmail, who ended up dying in a motel room before they could carry out their scheme. But Peggy didn't say she killed any of them, according to people who heard these statements. She just said that she'd helped kill them. But unlike with Lacey Harness, there is some physical evidence that could suggest that Peggy was there that night in the Kliznikow house. Because it's not just her post-murder ramblings at Jackie's house or the gas can, or what her daughter Samantha told Billy and Paula. There's also physical evidence. Because while the house was nearly burned down to the ground, there was some evidence to survive the fire. Evidence that Greg and his family and his defense team at trial never knew about. But all the way back in 1999, Billy Cleghorn, his brother Jackie Cleghorn, and Jackie's wife Rachel Cleghorn did seem to know about it. All of them gave statements about the things Peggy Horn said in the weeks after the murders. And they said that when she was geeking out and rambling and talking about the spirits and the flashlights and the murder, there was one more thing she mentioned that all of these witnesses heard directly. Something about being worried about a shirt or a blouse that she'd left behind. And Paula Lackamore, who wasn't at Jackie's house to witness Peggy's unraveling, was told the same thing by Samantha Horn, that her mother had left behind a shirt and they were worried about getting caught. But there was no evidence of any shirt in the case files. Not in the evidence logs, not in the crime scene pictures, not in discovery, nowhere. It was this weird little detail that popped up a few times, but never merited much attention because there was nothing else to go on. So, as important as this shirt thing might have been, it just kind of slipped by. And so did the years. Greg was convicted in 2000 and began decades of fighting for another chance through the appellate process. Part of that fight meant getting as many of the official case files from different agencies as possible. The Putnam County Sheriff's Office, the TBI, and the Fire Marshal. In 2015, after dozens and dozens and dozens of public information requests were filed by Linda, Greg's amazing and relentless advocate, they finally received a copy of the arson records from the State Fire Marshal's Department.
And the other issue we had when I wrote to the Bomb and Arson Division in Nashville, I believe it was in 2015, we got their records, and inside of their package of information was a receipt for a shirt that was found on the picnic table at the where the crime was committed at the Kliznikow's residence.
This receipt was in fact a statement dated August 8th, 1998, 3 days after the murders. It read,
I, Sergei Lebed, found the striped shirt on the picnic table in the rear of the house on August 6, 1998. I turned it in to the Putnam County Sheriff's Department on August 8, 1998. Signed, Sergei Lebed.
Sergei Lebed was Victor's son. The day after the murders, Lebed found a shirt on a picnic table in the yard behind his parents' burned-out house. And he turned that shirt in to the Putnam County Sheriff's Office. From there, it disappeared. This receipt came as a shock to Greg's family because it was potential physical evidence that had never been disclosed to the defense. And it also seemed like it might explain Peggy's rantings about a shirt she left behind. The shirt was a ways behind the house on a picnic table, far enough away where it hadn't gotten burned in the fire, and possibly left there that night after someone fled the house after setting it on fire. And this receipt would seem to be independent corroboration of what Billy, Jackie, Rachel, and Paula all said back in 1999. They'd have had no way of knowing about a shirt left behind at the crime scene. It was never reported anywhere in any of the news coverage, and they didn't even know what shirt Peggy was referring to, although Lacey did.
To best of my knowledge, it was a white shirt that she was wearing. It was long sleeve. It seemed like it had some flowers on it. And she had it tied up. You know how they used to do it? They take the bottom of it, tie it up, and just button the first over top of it. That's what she left in. But I never seen that shirt again.
Lacey never saw the shirt again, and neither did Peggy. It was evidence suppressed by the state and made to disappear.
Greg didn't know how to play guitar when he entered prison, but to win and keep his wife Becky's heart, he learned how.
You know, I learned to play guitar because Becky wanted me to, and I just, learned for her. She said if I learned to play Hotel California, she'd love me forever, and I learned to play the heck out of that thing.
The years, however, take a toll on everyone. Despite what some people may think about Greg's infidelity and his sudden marriage to Becky, those things weren't a reflection on how he ever felt about her. Greg loved Becky and their daughter Rebecca with all his heart. We have years of letters he wrote to friends and family in which he spoke about Becky. Remember when Rocky Harmon, Greg's childhood friend with severe psychiatric issues, wrote to him and apologized for testifying against Greg? In one of his letters back to Rocky, Greg wrote the following.
You know how I felt about Becky. I had talked to you several months before that we were seriously talking about trying to have a baby. We were already thinking up names. Remember, you practically begged me not to. You said Becky was not the woman for me. You told me that I was making a mistake. Becky and I have been together over 3 years now. She is not the person you knew. Becky is the only woman for me. I thank you once again for introducing us. You're not going to believe this, but Becky has never yelled at me in anger. I told her early on that Elizabeth used to hit me and yell at me. I told Becky that I wouldn't put up with it and wouldn't treat her that way either. We respect each other, talk things out like adults. Becky has stayed by my side all this time because she knows I am innocent. I was in bed asleep with her when Victor and Ala were killed. I just want to go home where I belong, taking care of my wife and baby girl.
Greg never did return home to be with his wife and daughter, and as the years wore on, Becky was no longer able to stay by his side.
Becky and Greg, Becky was seeing another man, and she told me that she felt guilty about, she was actually living with this man named David. And they were putting a life together. David had a daughter a couple of years older than Rebecca, and she and Rebecca were good friends. And then Becky actually moved into David's house, and so they had a home, you know, for a change. And she only wanted a divorce because she felt bad about living with another man and being married to Greg. She just couldn't swing back and forth between going to the prison and then going back to David. I know that she tried. She had talked to Greg, I guess, about a divorce. And when I got wind of it, I went to her and talked to her, and I said, Becky, don't do this. Greg has not asked you to do that. Of course you have needs that need to be met. Just don't divorce Greg. And so she didn't for a while, but then she did finally go ahead and divorce him.
Why didn't you want her to divorce them?
Because they were still in love. They loved each other. They really did. They loved each other. And when they were at the junkyard in Florida, they were the happiest little couple you've ever seen. Becky was craving French fries the whole time. They were thrilled about being pregnant, looking forward to the baby. They just had a lot of fun there. You know, they were free. They were able to love. They were beautiful together.
Thanks to Joyce's pleas, Becky did hold on a few years more, but eventually she did file for a divorce. She ended up getting married again to a man named Jeff, but the marriage was abusive and dragged her back into drugs and alcohol. She also suffered from crippling rheumatoid arthritis and smoked pot to relieve the pain. When Becky gave birth to a son and marijuana was detected in her and her baby's bloodstreams, the Department of Children's Services got involved and decided that neither child was safe in the home. In 2009, Greg received a notice from DSC telling him to appear for a hearing to determine if Rebecca would be removed from her mother's home. Greg was deeply opposed to the move. Having grown up far from his own mother, he worried about the impact being in a stranger's home would have on his 10-year-old daughter. He wrote back, "My daughter Rebecca means more to me than anyone else. I love her with all my heart, and I would never want to see her hurt by anyone. I know that Becky and Jeff love Rebecca as much as I do, so I do not want to see Rebecca taken from her mother." For the next 3 years, Greg fought DSC from prison as Becky struggled to stay sober and her husband was ordered to take parenting and domestic violence classes. But by early 2012, Becky was on her third strike with the court, having tested positive for drugs thrice, had separated from her husband Jeff and gotten a restraining order, and both of her children were poised to be taken from her and placed elsewhere. At that point, Becky's mother, Judy, attempted to have all parental rights terminated to get full custody of her granddaughter, but again, Greg fought it. He believed that Becky was a good mother, and her children shouldn't be taken from her, and his own rights certainly shouldn't be terminated. In January 2012, Greg wrote a letter to Becky's mother-in-law, Jeff's mother, to tell her what was happening and to encourage her to help Becky. Greg wrote the following. "I know Becky has rheumatoid arthritis and is in constant pain. In addition, she's probably experiencing a great deal of stress and depression. It is not unusual under those circumstances to self-medicate when someone cannot afford proper legal, medical, and psychological care. Becky received a disability check until age 18 because of severe dyslexia. What she needs is assistance with housing and medical/psychological care. When reading is easy and automatic is breathing, it is impossible for us to truly understand how difficult dyslexia makes her life. Becky needs help, not condemnation."
Greg also wrote about a new ray of hope he had of getting out of prison.
"The University of Tennessee Knoxville Innocence Clinic has recently begun representing me in my criminal case. Extensive new evidence has been obtained that requires a new trial be granted. Since most every relevant state witness has recanted, the assistant DA admitted there is a considerable amount of reasonable doubt, and the district attorney has been disbarred, I do not anticipate being retried. I would never wish to take Rebecca away from Becky. However, I fully intend to seek joint custody as soon as I am released and make sure my little girl always has a good home."
The next month, on February 9th, 2012, Greg wrote his little girl a letter. It's handwritten, just a few short paragraphs, and folded inside are now almost decade-old flowers, crumbling and fragile. The letter reads,
"Happy Valentine's Day. I hope you get lots of candy and flowers. I wish I could send you some, but I lost my industry job when I was moved. I picked some flowers for you last year. I pressed them in my dictionary in the flower section. I hope your mom has a happy birthday on the 22nd. Love, Daddy."
The very next day, on February 10th, 2012, Becky Pollard, the love of Greg's life, was killed in a car accident. Becky was traveling on a two-lane road when an oncoming truck with three passengers swerved into her lane, colliding with her car headfirst. Along with Becky, all three men in the truck perished too. Becky was 31 years old when she was killed, and she left behind two children and a lifetime of struggles. And at 12 years of age, Rebecca was left motherless and with a father behind bars, serving two life sentences. By this time in 2012, Greg did have someone new in his life, someone we mentioned in an earlier episode, Jarrah Swafer.
Well, I am originally from Florida, and I moved to Tennessee in October of 2005, and I went to work for the real estate agent who founded our house here, and she happened to work in the same office as Greg's mom did, Joyce. Joyce and I hit it off from the moment we met. We're still friends to this day, and of course, Greg and his situation are a huge part of her life, have been for, unfortunately, way too long, so we got to talking about all of that fairly early on. And I remember thinking to myself, man, that just sucks so much. I'm so glad it's not happening to me.
To refresh your memory, Jarrah was the one who managed to get Keith Herbstreit to do all those firework reenactments and get the recantation letters from Marlon Ray, one of the two men who had been trying to buy rabbits at the Heron Farm. Jarrah went from working with Greg's mother to meeting his then six-year-old daughter, to then researching his case, to then meeting Greg himself after exchanging letters for months. It took a while for Jarrah to go from interested friend to romantically involved with Greg, and she did so cautiously, having to navigate the other relationships that came along with the package, like his mother and daughter and Greg's ex, Becky. And along with the personal relationship, Jarrah threw herself headfirst into the case. But it's not easy being involved with an incarcerated person. For years, Greg and Jarrah had the kind of relationship that becomes inevitable with someone who is still fighting for their freedom. They gave each other personal support and loving companionship, but Jarrah also filled every day with Greg's casework. And after 6 years, Jarrah had to walk away.
I was exhausted. I was absolutely exhausted. We had, case-wise, gotten to the point that I was not really participating anymore. And not because I didn't want to, but I felt I had taken on more of a sort of a secretarial role. Copies of this, can you type this? Investigative type part of things was done in the sense that where he was in the process of appeal, I mean, he was doing his habeas, and I mean, it was just, it became just a personal relationship, which is fine. And there was never any issue there. But I realized that my entire life was about him and his case. And I did nothing, thought about nothing, talked about nothing but that. And I hadn't had a good night's sleep in 6 years. And my stress level was through the roof. And that's on me. And I'm losing myself. I can't do this anymore. And he kissed my forehead and he said, "I understand." I'm like, "Just be mad at me. I mean, for crap's sake." He said, "No, why would I be mad at you for this?" He said, "I love you. I want you to be happy." He said, "If this is not making you happy, if me is not making, don't, no, go. Go live your life." And I thought, and of course, you have to be like awesome about it. Like, dude. So, Yeah.
This was around the time that Becky died in 2012, and around the time, as Jara said, that she had exhausted all she could do from an investigative end, and there finally seemed to be some legal movement on the case. Which is what he's referring to in his letter to Becky's mother-in-law. The University of Tennessee Knoxville Innocence Clinic did exist at one time, and in 2011, it did indeed take Greg's case. That was the same year that new evidence was disclosed through Greg's diligence and persistence. Greg and his family had attempted for years to get a copy of the DA's file in this case, but they refused to comply with the public information requests that Greg and his family had filed. Finally, Greg sued the DA's office, and a copy of their file was turned over in March of 2011. In that file was a copy of a discovery document that District Attorney David Patterson had turned over to Greg's attorney, Marshall Judd. It was dated June 5th, 2000, 4 months before Greg's trial. The document was an FBI interview of an incarcerated man that we'll call Dwayne, and we'll tell you in a bit why we're giving him an alias. The interview notes show that this interview happened in May of 2000, in the presence of Dwayne's lawyer. Dwayne told the FBI that he had personal knowledge of Sam Horn's meth dealings, because Dwayne himself was heavily involved in the drug scene. Dwayne also knew a number of Sam's relatives, including two of his nephews, Alex Horn and Mike Horn. Mike, you may recall, was the man who left engraved dentures when he murdered a woman in 2010. But 10 years prior, when Dwayne gave the statement to the FBI, both Mike and Alex Horn were incarcerated with him. According to the statement, Alex Horn told Dwayne that Sam Horn had killed the Kloznikows because they threatened to turn Sam in for cooking meth if he didn't make good on his back payments. The statement went on to say, according to Alex Horn, Sam Horn's wife went over earlier in the day and visited with the Kloznikows. At that time, Horn's wife supposedly opened a window so that Sam could come back and get into the residence later. Now, the shocking part about this disclosure of this statement in 2011 wasn't what Dwayne had to say. Dwayne was one of maybe a half dozen men in prison that had approached Greg to tell him that they knew Sam Horn was responsible for the murders. So, Greg was generally familiar with what Dwayne had to say. But he hadn't seen this particular statement before. His attorneys had never told him about it. It was clear why, though, because what shocked Greg was that the FBI statement identified Dwayne's attorney as none other than Marshall Judd, Greg's own defense attorney. And Judd never disclosed to his own client, Greg Lance, or to his co-counsel, John Nisbet, that he had any conflict of interest. As Greg's attorney, Judd had a duty to disclose Dwayne's statement to Greg. But as Dwayne's attorney, he had a duty to Dwayne not to disclose the statement, which he used to try and get Dwayne a plea deal, instead of using to help exonerate Greg. Due to these conflicts, Judd should have recused himself from the trial, but he didn't. Judd never disclosed the statement, or even that, ironically, a copy of it was then turned over to him in discovery. And DA General Gibson, knowing full well that Greg's attorney was also representing Dwayne at the same time, didn't disclose it to the court either.
Greg raised all these issues in a 2012 petition for writ of error quorum nobis, which is a post-conviction mechanism to bring a new fact to the attention of the trial court, much like the more commonly heard petition for post-conviction relief. But an error quorum nobis petition must be filed within 1 year of the discovery of the new fact, meaning Greg had until March 12, 2012 to file it. He brought this to the attention of the Innocence Clinic repeatedly, frantically, but got no response. Out of sheer desperation, he filed it himself pro se on the very day it was due. The petition was summarily dismissed just a couple of months later, and Greg appealed it, but the appeal too was denied. In these past 20 years, all of Greg's appeals have been denied. His direct appeal in 2003, denied. His discretionary appeal to the Supreme Court of Tennessee, denied. His 2004 pro se petition for post-conviction relief, denied. His 2012 petition for writ of error coram nobis, denied. A painstakingly handwritten pro se federal habeas petition filed in 2007, denied. A writ of cert to the U.S. Supreme Court, denied. And with every appellate denial was the denial of dozens upon dozens of motions that Greg had filed. After years of fighting, Greg finally went silent. His depression deepened and began to accept that he may never get out of prison. But then Linda and Joyce got a copy of those fire marshal records in 2015, the ones containing the receipt of the shirt that we believe that Peggy Horn may have left behind on the night of the murders, and that put some life back into their advocacy. Linda created a website for Greg, justiceforgreg.com, and Joyce wrote nearly two dozen letters to as many innocence organizations as she could find. The Jeffrey Deskovich Foundation, the Equal Justice Initiative, Centurion Ministries, the House of Renewed Hope, a dozen different innocence projects, and repeatedly to innocence super attorney Kathleen Zellner. Not long after, the undisclosed team came across Greg's case and reached out to the contact person on his website, which turned out to be Linda Bousman. And here we are, nearly 2 years later, looking forward to what we can do to help Greg get home.
You may be asking, what can be done now? Now that in the past 20 years, so many appeals have failed. Well, the truth is there is still much more that can be done, and there is still much more to find out. We've mentioned a couple of times how difficult it's been for Greg's family to get copies of official files, and that the TBI never turned over their file. Well, once Greg gets back in court, a judge can compel the TBI to turn over their file, and who knows what it could contain, what exculpatory, previously withheld evidence it could have hidden away. We know there's a lot of things that were never turned over to the defense, like a plaster cast that a neighbor witnessed the police take of tire treads at the crime scene, like pictures investigators took of Greg's hands and arms and legs on the day after the murders. There are even dozens of missing lab reports that Greg's defense team has never seen. Then there's the evidence that could be DNA tested. And today's DNA testing is not like DNA testing of the past. It is much, much more sensitive and can pick up traces, even traces from a mere human touch, that were unimaginable in the past. All of the physical evidence, like the wire cutters found in the Klesnikow yard, the gun, the cord, the flashlight, and the batteries inside the flashlight, and most importantly, the shirt that Victor's son found in his parents' yard. All of it can be DNA tested, because none of it ever has been. There should also still be cans of evidence taken from the crime scene that new forensic techniques could shed some light on. At least, we think those cans of evidence should still exist. In 2006, a strange odor assaulted the workers at the Putnam County Justice Center. It reeked like an open sewer, according to the local newspaper, making people sick and nauseous. And when they investigated, it turned out to be coming from the evidence vault. And in the vault, they traced it to one particular box with metal cans of evidence from the Greg Lance case. According to the court clerk, they weren't sure what was in the cans, but one of them had its lid blown right off, and that was where the smell was coming from. They resealed the evidence, and then they used fans and air fresheners to get rid of the smell. So yes, those cans should still exist for further testing, with their rotten sewage smell and all. Recently, a witness also gave us a new lead on possible physical evidence connecting Sam Horn to the murders that, once checked out, well, we'll brief you on in a future update episode. Then there are still the fingerprints found in the batteries in the flashlight that was strapped to the gun. The prints didn't match Greg or anyone he knew, but they've never been compared to Peggy or Sam Horn. And we have Peggy's prints, right here in our own files. But Sam, magic man that he has always been, being able to escape from the law, he had no prints on file at the sheriff's office. But in 2005, the TBI told Greg that they did have a copy of Sam Horn's prints, and we can get them through a court order, and then we can have the prints found in the batteries compared to Sam and Peggy's prints. There are also so many witnesses, like the ones we heard from throughout the series, who connect the Horns to the murders, like Dwayne, who in the years since his FBI statement has repeatedly corresponded with Greg's family, and he's even corresponded with me, assuring us that he's willing to testify when he's called. But for now, Duane is incarcerated in a dangerous place and he's scared of law enforcement. So we thought it best that his identity be protected. And let's not forget all of Lacey's new admissions, including information we've never heard before. And if my hunch is right, Lacey has much more information he's able to give us. And maybe he one day will. If no other reason but to keep himself from getting dragged into a future prosecution. There are witnesses who were willing to testify years ago, but they never made it in front of a jury, like Billy Cleghorn and Paula Lackamore and Chris Henry, and others we didn't even get around to naming in this series because, well, that would have required another half dozen episodes. And I'm willing to bet that there are others who know something, people we haven't even heard of, but who may come forward. Because according to Billy Cleghorn and others, nearly everyone in Sam's orbit knew that he did it. And that was quite a lot of people. Which takes us to the Horns themselves. Sam died a long time ago, in 2002. His death was ignoble, to put it kindly. He overdosed at his cousin's house, and instead of calling an ambulance, his cousin dragged Sam's body to some other location where it was discovered, abandoned, days later.
Sam had a massive heart attack doing some methamphetamine that hadn't been properly
cooked.
Right.
Put together, and that's
pH.
What killed him.
It's a stage of it. Well, I ain't gonna go into that.
Yeah, that's okay.
But it happened at his cousin's house before he passed.
Where he drug him outside.
James. They were doing it in the house.
What was his name, James?
All I know is it's called Monkey Man.
Monkey Man. That's right, Monkey Man.
He died in his yard.
Yeah, and that was his.
Or he's in the house, garage. and they drug him outside.
Yeah, he drug him out. Probably put him on a fence post or a tree.
Put him in the. It was snowing.
Really?
They put him out there in the snow.
Yeah.
Supposedly found him the next morning outside.
Yeah.
The next year, in 2003, you'll be surprised to learn that Greg sued the estate of Sam and Peggy Horn. His civil complaint stated, quote, Sam Horn, with the aid of Peggy Horn, killed Victor and Alla Klesnikow and then conspired to cover up their guilt and place the blame on Greg Lance. Their acts and continuing cover-up have led to the wrongful arrest and imprisonment of Greg Lance. Greg asked for $10 million in damages and a declaratory judgment that Sam Horn killed Victor and Alla Klesnikow. 3 years later, in 2006, the court entered a default judgment against Peggy Horn, putting aside the issue of damages for later. But later never did come, probably because the estate of Sam and Peggy Horn didn't have a dime to its name. Or maybe it was because Peggy just up and left. According to a statement that Rachel Cleghorn gave to defense investigator Jim Harkin years ago, Peggy wanted out of the area as soon as possible. Right after the murders, she was ready to pack up and flee and start over somewhere else. Peggy Horn, said Rachel, wanted to become a different woman. Well, we don't know if she became a different woman, but we do know that she's still alive. She did leave Tennessee, as did her daughter Samantha Horn, and, well, we know where they are. We also know through various sources that they have been listening to this podcast, and we've been told that they are very anxious about all of this. It's likely that Peggy and Samantha Horn will continue to follow what happens in Greg's case as we get back into court, as we compare fingerprints and test DNA that has never been done before. I know I would be watching like a hawk with breath held. It might even be that one day one of them decides to come forward, hoping perhaps to be able to make a deal before anyone is implicated through new testing. Anything's possible. Confessions, exonerations, and plea deals alike. Especially because Greg's case has caught the eye of arguably the most powerful law firm in Tennessee, and more than one Innocence Project. And like in all of our other cases, Undisclosed will be there every step of the way for as long as it takes to get justice for the victims by helping exonerate the innocent. We have high hopes that one day Greg will join the ranks of the other defendants we've covered, who are now finally home. A big thanks to all of our listeners for joining us for the Greg Land series. You can learn more about his case from the documents on our website, undisclosed-podcast.com, or by visiting Greg's website, justiceforgreg.com. That's justice for the number four, greg.com. To wrap up this year, we'll be dropping a couple of bonus episodes, and then we'll return in the spring with a number of new cases, all leading up to our big fall season led by Susan Simpson. It's a case involving two murders, potentially three wrongfully convicted people, and a killer who might soon walk free. You won't believe this and the other incredible stories coming in 2020. Next time on Undisclosed. Greg Lance has been in prison since 1999. If you'd like to drop him a note of support or a card or anything to let him know that you're following his story and thinking about him, address your letters to Gregory Paul Lance, ID 003-25463. The Bledsoe County Correctional Complex, BLEDSOE, Bledsoe County Correctional Complex, located at 1045 Horsehead Road in Pikeville, Tennessee, zip code 37367. Now, lots of thank yous. A big thank you to all of our sponsors who helped make this episode, this series, and really all of our work possible. We could not continue to investigate wrongful convictions and try to help those wrongfully convicted if we didn't have our sponsors. So, if you want to support our work, if you want to support the folks that we are trying to help in our series, please support our sponsors. They make the production possible. Thank you to our Wizard of Oz, who keeps everything running like clockwork behind the scenes, executive producer Mithal Thelhan. Thank you to our audio producer extraordinaire, Rebecca Lavoie, host of one of my favorite podcasts, Crime Writers On. Thank you, Baluki, for our logo, Patrick Cortez for our theme song. Thank you to Linda Bozeman and the family of Greg Lance for working with us in order for us to do an investigation into this case. And a huge thank you to my legal intern for this entire series, Asa Qureshi, who has just put in days and days and weeks of going through documents and organizing things and just making my life easier. And finally, thank you all of our listeners for staying with us case after case, year after year. Follow us on social media. We're on Twitter at the handle @undisclosedpod, and remember to tweet us your questions for the undisclosed addendum using the hashtag UDaddendum. We're also on Facebook and Instagram, and our website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com.